America in the Clinton years, we may be nostalgic for them now, if only for the sense of peace and prosperity they represent in our memories. It's easy to feel now that those years are over, past, done, and that we have entered a new era of insecurity. Much went right during the Clinton years, but much clearly went wrong as well. During this hour of Focus 580, we will chronicle some of the key events of the 8 years that ended so recently and look to see if, like tea leaves, they might tell us something about the road ahead. Our guest is veteran commentator and historian Haynes Johnson. As a reporter, editor, and columnist for The Washington Star and The Washington Post, he has witnessed and written about the great domestic and international events of the past four decades. In 1966, Haynes Johnson won the Pulitzer Prize for distinguished national reporting of the civil rights struggle in Selma, Alabama. This marked the first time that a father and son both received Pulitzer Prizes for reporting. His father, Malcolm Johnson, won in 1949 for his New York Sun series, Crime on the Waterfront, which formed the basis for the Academy Award-winning film On the Waterfront. Haynes Johnson is the author of numerous books, including the bestsellers Sleepwalking Through History, America in the Reagan Years, and The Bay of Pigs. He was on the original panel of PBS's Washington Week in Review and was a weekly commentator for NBC's Today Show and is now a regular commentator on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. He also teaches at the University of Maryland, where he holds the Knight Chair in Journalism. And during this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk with Haynes Johnson about his latest book, The Best of Times, America in the Clinton Years, published on October 1st by Harcourt. As we talk with Haynes Johnson, you are welcome to join our conversation. Questions and comments on the topic are welcome from you. All you have to do is call us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL if you match the letters with the numbers. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around Illinois, Indiana, via the internet, anywhere in the U.S. Use that, we'll pay for the call. That number is 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-WILL. Haynes Johnson, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for that very flattering introduction. I appreciate it.
Well,
and for talking about the book.
Well, you certainly have done a lot of great work, so we're glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
I think no matter what we thought about Bill Clinton and about America in the Clinton years, we're kind of reassessing and looking at those years quite a bit differently than we did just a short time ago.
Well, certainly, and I hope so, because what I did in this book, 5 years of effort, of study, of travel, of interviews, and looking at the period, was the belief that we were passing through a consequential period unlike any in our history, and that whatever, however it ended, it was bound to affect us into the future, and there'd be lessons to be learned from it, more lessons than one would have anticipated, tragically, as it turns out now. But the essence of it was that we had the greatest opportunity in all of American history to deal with long-term problems affecting the society and the world. We emerged onto the stage of history in the 90s. The Cold War was over. We were the only surviving superpower, number one, too much arrogance maybe, feeling, but nonetheless, we didn't face the sort of Cold War terrors that we had confronted. The Soviet Union was gone. All the isms of history in the 20th century had faded away. Communism, socialism, fascism, Nazism, all of that was gone. And here we were in the biggest setting off and the biggest boom ever in American history, ever in the history of the world, the greatest transfer of wealth, and a population that was energetic, talented, resourceful, witnessing the biggest scientific, medical, technological revolution ever in history. All of these great things we had in our past, and we could do anything we wanted to deal with long-term problems, but we didn't do it. We didn't pay attention. We allowed ourselves to be diverted by scandal, by entertainment, by the fragmentation of the media culture, by the sensationalism of the news, and by our own inattention and our belief somehow that we were impregnable. Mm-hmm. That we, whatever the forces outside the world, didn't really matter, it didn't affect us. Government was irrelevant, who was in the White House was irrelevant, it didn't really affect people's lives, you could just cash in on the boom and ride the rocket on up to the past. Great success stories. And there were great success stories, but it ended. It was illusory, and we lived in myths, and the world is not secure. As I say in the closing pages of the book, we faced more challenges that we didn't meet, and we squandered the opportunities. That's a tragedy. I didn't realize when I was setting out to do this that I would be writing a tragedy of our times, but I did.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. Well, you know, the triumph of American technology over the past decade has been just amazing.
Yes.
But by the same token, I think people don't feel that it's impacted their lives in positive ways like maybe we had hoped.
Well, I don't want to be a Luddite. I mean, Certainly the technological triumphs of our society were marvelous. They do affect our lives. They will continue to affect our lives. But it wasn't the new sort of defining thing that was changing history forever, as people believe. It wasn't, we didn't have a, quote, new economy that was going to make all that had gone before it seem irrelevant itself. And we didn't repeal the forces of history. There was a belief that with the Internet and the new linked world, we would forge a new economy and we'd repeal the market forces. They only went up, much like the 1920s. They never went down. It wasn't a speculative bubble. It was just something new and transforming. That was the first great and lasting illusion. The bubble just kept floating up, and that bubble burst before I ended the story. And the second one, the one that was really tragic, was the larger belief that we had repealed history itself, that we were on the cusp of an age in which all of the old problems of the world, the wars and threats of wars and so forth, were fading into the past, and the United States was, and its system was impregnable, and everything was going our way. And that, of course, is the greatest myth of all.
You write that despite their blessings during this period, Americans increasingly felt something was wrong with their society.
Yeah, I kept in traveling around the country with all of the good things we had. We weren't united, and there was a sort of distaste for the scandal culture. At the same time, we enjoyed it. We focused on O.J. Simpson and Monica Lewinsky, and even up until September 11th, it was all Chandra all the time. It's amazing to look back on that, how much time we spent allowing ourselves to be trivialized and diverted from the essence of the times. And there was also a great a sense of overall corruption in our life and destructiveness, that the pall of attack culture. Our politics was vicious and pernicious and virulent, and we were attacking each other. We were attacking public officials and the idea of government and public service and so forth. And Americans felt that and reacted to it, and we weren't together or united as a country. We were all living independently of each other.
This is an interesting observation, because I think that for a long time many people have complained about this and said, you know, that this is the problem. We're not united. We're so, you know, like enamored with or bombarded by scandal and the way the media treats politics, you know, as a war.
Yeah.
But we seem to be powerless to really do anything about it.
Well, that was the whole problem. I look back on the period, and it's frustrating, and it's really kind of enraging, because we allowed ourselves to be diverted. Even though we were disgusted by it, we enjoyed it. I'm generalizing, of course.
Sure.
Not everybody did, but the audiences were huge, and the media was culpable. It fed a new audience, created new talking heads, shouting each other every night, ideological food fights, with nothing much to say except stir comment and debate and divisiveness. And we attacked our leaders. We attacked people who went into public service. It was very difficult. I don't know how many people I know who said they would never serve again under the climate of the way the standards have changed. We looked at the values of public life versus private lives was sundered, was eroded. So all of this took place at the same time we were going through this great boom, this great success, this wonderful new age. And it was a period of time I think we're going to look back on, already are looking back on, and saying, yeah, there were some good things. You might feel nostalgic for it, but also we didn't pay attention, and we're paying the price for it now.
Mm-hmm. Your book covers a lot of different topics. Obviously, the rise of technology, computers and the internet economy, and subsequent dot-com boost, biotechnology, the O.J. Simpson trial, media deregulation, the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal, a whole bunch of other things. And in some ways, I mean, it was written obviously before September 11th, but in many ways it sort of encapsulates all the events that essentially, it seems to me, ended on September 11th, or, you know, if not before, but that was certainly a defining point of ending of this era.
Yes, it did, Jack. And the book is a narrative, and it goes through the narrative through the election of 2000, which I call the fiasco, because it was a fiasco. And I didn't know what would be the climactic, final exclamation point of the end of an era, but I suspected it would be like the stock market crash of 1929 that led to the Great Depression and World War II. But because I think the speculative bubble had already burst by the time I finished, and the economy was slumping very badly, and that era was over. But the last two pages of the book, I talk about the challenges facing the future, the Americans, and I specifically address the threat of fundamentalist terrorism and groups zealously divided fundamentalist world, the Islamic world, and I name the Taliban's possessed of weapons of mass terror, and suggesting that our future in this new millennium world is going to be less secure even than the long Cold War period of the last century, and that because these groups possess these, and they're zealots and determined, and they're determined to destroy us, and we faced a fundamental crisis, really, building. It was all there, and I wrote that 7 months ago, before the World Trade Center. I don't say that with any pride or foresight, because we should have been aware that we faced these things. It was part of the inattention of the period that we didn't pay attention to it, even though we had warning after warning after warning that there were problems building outside our borders as well as within that we didn't pay attention to because we were lulled by the success and the roar of the good times and the feeling that we had repealed history. That's the tragedy.
We're talking this morning with Haynes Johnson. He is a veteran journalist and commentator, author of many books. The one we're discussing is his latest, The Best of Times, America in the Clinton Years, published by Harcourt. We have one caller waiting and would welcome others if you'd like to join us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. We have a listener on a cell phone. Why don't we include them in our conversation?
Sure.
On line number one, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
I just have a question for your guest. I would be very curious to learn about his feelings regarding our lack of leadership during the Clinton administration years by setting what I would conceive as being an amoralistic tone and without leadership to help us focus on anything except his illicit behavior and the first president to be impeached since Andrew Johnson. Did that not set and predispose us to a series of apathy in this country? Thank you.
Well, certainly, there's no question what you've talked about, the scandal culture, as I called it, the attack culture, which culminated in the impeachment of the president, which should not have happened, by the way. The country had it right. They were way ahead of Washington and the prosecutors and so forth. They didn't, people never supported Clinton's immorality or his actions of his personal character, but they had it right about the country shouldn't be dragged through that kind of process. The attack took up years of time and diverted us from paying attention and our leadership. And in fact, the Congress and the president were so tied up with scandal hunt for year after year, long before the impeachment process, that nothing was being done, no attention was being paid, basically, to the main questions facing the society. They couldn't even pass bills there. They were so ravenous in the period of the assault culture. And it was the tragedy was that Bill Clinton, for all of his successes, and he'd had many failures, his own failures of personality and character, and he gave his enemies the weapons that helped destroy him, but the country was destroyed. The country was diverted. The country was taken apart, and as a consequence, we also, as the people, we stopped paying attention to government, to Washington, to We stopped voting increasingly less, and there was a great disgust about the cumulative, about the whole political culture, and I think rightly so. And if there's a lesson from this, it's that we should vow never, never to allow ourselves to turn on each other and destroy each other within, because we need to have a unity of purpose, not of faults for debate. We need to have heavy debates on issues, but not this destruction of character, well-financed, and filled with hate that we went through in the period of the 90s.
You write quite a bit in the book about this particular episode, the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal, and there's some great original reporting on that. But, you know, and I certainly, you know, I think that Bill Clinton deserves his fair share of blame. The way he handled it was poor, to say the least.
Yes.
But I think that it's also true. You know, at the time, most Americans were saying, enough.
Yes,
we don't need to hear more about this. We need to attend to business. And Congress was unable to hear that message.
That's exactly right. You that's the point I was trying to make and try to make in the book, that no one, there was no, not a matter of praising Bill Clinton's character or his feckless, his betrayal of his wife and family, his lying to the country and all that. All that was, people condemned it very much. But they saw the larger point very clearly. We shouldn't be destroying ourselves with these attacks that were in themselves not that significant to the performance of the public life, and that, in fact, we allowed ourselves to go into this pit. And I think that was a great loss to the country, and it helped to set a tone where we turned away from focusing on and dealing with, as you said, the Congress, and particularly, I must say, the Republican Party, in the sense that a wing of the Republican Party was so determined to get Clinton, they went to any grounds, and the prosecution and so forth. When you look back on the history of it, I think it's, as I say in the book, no one emerges looking good. Not Bill Clinton, certainly. Not the people who arrayed against him. Not the prosecutors who spent $60 million, didn't get a single indictment for year after year after year, found nothing criminal or culpable in all that process, but dragged the country through this scandal culture. Not the attack people who were joined by the media, a lot of the media, who are spending a great deal of money to raise these questions that we were just scandal-ridden. That's what we can't afford to let ourselves do again. I really passionately believe that. I hope it doesn't happen under Mr. Bush's watch, and I think, of course, the world has changed, so maybe we're free of that curse.
I won't include another caller, but just to put a real fine point on this, I remember on the morning that Monica Lewinsky was testifying before a federal grand jury, there was, you know, President Clinton announced missile strikes, cruise missiles and other attacks on two sites affiliated with Osama bin Laden.
That's right.
One in Sudan and one in Afghanistan. And we later found out that, you know, these the targets, at least the one in the Sudan, was not what, you know, the administration claimed at the time. But it seemed that we are at the beginning of this conflict that now we are so caught up in, what we did not have the attention or the willpower to really understand what was happening and to deal with it appropriately.
That's right, and that's a very good point, because the attack on bin Laden's sanctuary, supposedly, we believe them, we fired missiles and so forth, and not only that, we now know, it was not known at the time, Clinton signed executive orders authorizing the intelligence agents to get bin Laden, to go to eliminate him and try to hunt him down. And but the whole backdrop of the period, my point is, the larger period, the scandal culture, the impeachment business, the preoccupation with Monica and all that business, and the impeachment that went through completely stopped the government of the United States, and the country itself stopped paying attention to foreign news. It was a failure of Clinton. He had a responsibility to sound the bell even louder than he did, but we were all caught up in that period of time, and that so that we didn't really focus on it at all, at least as we should have.
And we're paying the price for it now, certainly.
Yes, we are paying the price for it now. That is exactly the point. Point I was trying to make in the epilogue when I talked about the Taliban and Afghanistan and the fundamentalism and people possessed of weapons of mass terror and determined to use them, and the fundamentalist strife between fundamentalist Islamic culture, part of it, not all of it, and Western civilization. That's what we're into right now.
We have several callers to talk with. Let's go on and include them in our conversation. We'll go next to a listener in Charleston on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, thank you. First point, Bush the Elder declared the end of history. He was quoting some Harvard professor, I think. I don't think he had an original idea. But then he leaves office. And then Mr. Johnson saying the supposed good times came along. Then we have Bush the Younger come along, elected, you know, in this fiasco you just talked about. And Junior has the cavalier attitude toward the rest of the world, even Western Europeans. And on top of this, he has then left Israel to do whatever it wanted to do without any comments, and he takes a vacation. And if I were an Arab living in abject poverty and figured my hope was all gone, then the events of September 11th were inevitable. There's absolutely no other course could have been taken when we have hopeless people right in this nation who live in abject poverty. And these cavalier attitudes of this latest so-called president and having no thought about the future, as if the future was now, to quote Bush the Elder, that we have this triumphalism over communism, hollow as a dead tree, could not and not possibly answer the questions, pressing questions of this world, when we have 6 billion people and 99% of them have this tenuous hold on reality and upon their daily lives. And then the obvious contradictions of capitalist society that has exploited everything that is possible out of this planet and out of the human species that dwell on it. How is to think that then that we have saw the last of terrorism? I think these things are just beginning.
Well, you've raised enough conversations to have talk for days, I guess. But let me say, you quoted George Bush the First and the End of History. It wasn't a Harvard professor. It was Francis Fukuyama wrote a famous book called The End of History. And his thesis was that all the past problems of history were gone, and that the American and its system was transcendent, and we really wouldn't face the kind of clashes that were roiling the world previously. And of course that was a great delusion, as we now know. You talk about the population of the world. 5 billion people live in greater poverty. 1 billion live in greater material prosperity. That's the Western world. We've got to learn to educate ourselves to the forces of the world around us. We've got to do a much better job at covering, reporting on, paying attention to the sources of discontent in the world. It means everything's changing. As far as the president goes, we could talk about this all day. I do think that you're too hard on him. I was not a supporter of Mr. Bush the W, and I was worried about him. But I think that he is showing a larger maturity since the events of the September 11th. He's changed his policies almost dramatically about the need for American to have global alliances, about cooperation with other states, that we can't do it alone, that we need to have nation building, all the things that were not the lessons that he and his father had, as a matter of fact, coming out of the Gulf War period. So I think that we'll have to wait and see. I think he's doing, at the moment, it's been a terrible re-education project. You can see he's been aged, he looks, and he's got the support of the country, and the country's united. That's a different question now. We should vow, as I said before, to learn from the past and start acting and thinking and performing differently as a society. That's our challenge.
Yeah. Just a quick follow-up, then we'll continue with some more callers on that. I think it was clear that prior to September 11th, the United States was withdrawing largely from a lot of international agreements, obviously the Kyoto Protocol, everything from the Biological Weapons Protocol to, the International Criminal Court, a wide variety of agreements had been hammered out over years and decades in some cases. And then suddenly we find that we need the rest of the world. And I guess my question is for you, does this truly represent a change of attitude, not only on the part of the administration, but perhaps Congress, in realizing that we have to, go it alone. We have to be with others.
That's the really, you posed a really important, what are we learning and how are we acting differently? And we now see on the part of the administration and the American public, too, that the need for all these things. We were going unilaterally, America alone, America Rex, we could do what we wanted, we didn't need these treaties, we didn't need these alliances, including the global warming treaties, as you said, and the ban on bioterrorism and so forth. We didn't need that. We thought we were impregnable and invulnerable to it, and we could go it alone. I think that is a profound change, and I think it's a lasting change, because the condition we now face, as everyone from the president on down is saying repeatedly, this is a different kind of struggle than anything we've ever faced before, and it could go on for decades. And we're going to need the cooperation of all of the world. It's going to be involving our policies. It's going to be involving our policies in the Middle East and all these questions, and at home. So I think there's a permanent change in attitudes, because it's been forced upon us. One other change, I must say, is a recognition now that the demonization of government and public servants, which went on for two generations, attacking those who serve the government as being ignoble and corrupt and so forth, we now see a wellspring of reason why they exist. With the government, they are nurses, they are hospital workers, they are firemen, they are policemen, they are public school teachers. They're people that we allowed in the public health service to atrophy because they weren't funded, who were trying to find out the sources of anthrax. We need to have a public commitment to work in partnership with the private sector to build a better America. That's our challenge, and I think the country understands that now in a way that we didn't before. Far from being irrelevant, we need the best minds to deal with these very, very complex and challenging questions.
We're a little past our midpoint in our conversation this morning with Haynes Johnson, a veteran commentator and journalist. We're talking about his latest book, The Best of Times, America in the Clinton Years, and a variety of issues that it relates to the present on. And we have several callers waiting. We'd welcome others. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with our next caller in Belgium on line number one. Good morning.
Yes, I think the problem that your guest here is going on about needs to be described in another situation, in that the media itself is extremely responsible for all these feelings, because we can take two examples that I can just point out, just very simple examples. A couple years ago, there was an enormous hurricane that hit Honduras and then Central America, killed thousands and thousands of people. The only thing the media wanted to talk about was John Glenn going into space when he was 70 years old. Here recently, to use another example, we've had this horrible example in New York in September, and anthrax and all, and that's all that we hear on the news, period. In the middle of Europe, there's a horrid accident in the middle of a tunnel that kills hundreds of people. They don't even mention it. We are so self-centered in America, and our journalists are just, if it's not American, we're not going to talk about it. It's just horrible the way we have made ourselves so narrow-minded in our views that if it's not about our problems, they don't exist.
You know, it's funny. I hope if you read the book, you'll see I'm very savage about the news business. I know something about it. When the more you know about something you love, you think with respect and want it to be better, the more critical you are. And I certainly am very savage in the way in which many of the mainstream media will allow itself to be perverted by some of the techniques of the scandal area and the scandal hunt, and that's certainly true. But I think you draw far too great an indictment and condemnation. I mean, where did you learn the information about these train wrecks and the crosses and so forth.
I had to learn about it from the media. No, from the BBC. I didn't learn about it from American media, that's for sure.
Well, no, but it was reported in this country. I read it here, too. I mean, that's just, you are just doing the same thing you're accusing the media of doing. Yeah. And I think we ought to vow again to step back a minute. I want to see, I agree with you that we have done by and large, a poor job of covering the world, covering events around ourselves and our borders. Americans are self-absorbed, but we do cover events, and some of the best reporting and journalism in history is going on right now. It's been superb since September 11th. Now, before that, it wasn't as good, but you cannot tell me, if you read the New York Times every day, the Washington Post, or the Wall Street Journal, or the rest, or even the network news, you're getting a portrait of the world that is complex, that is better, and you have information. It's information in the society is part of the most difficult challenge for any citizen is to be informed. There is enormous amount of information there available to you if you want it. I think it should be better. I think we should vow not to have the sensation culture and so forth, but I don't have as bad of an indictment as you do.
Yeah. Well, you certainly do have an indictment of especially the entertainment values in media in the book. I just wanted to, reflect on this point a little bit because I think it's a really key issue, and that is the responsibility of citizens to go out and get the information that they feel they need to be informed. I was on a panel at Eastern Illinois University recently of several people in the media, newspapers, television, and in my case, public radio. And I just asked the students at Eastern Illinois University, about 200 kids, I asked, well, I call them kids myself now, but how many people get their news from television? Almost everybody raised their hand. How many people read newspapers? Maybe about a dozen out of 200 raised their hand. How many people listen to, for example, National Public Radio, which, of course, I'm very attuned to, and like two people in the entire room. So, this tells us people are, not necessarily getting the diversity of sources that they need to understand the world.
That's exactly right, and I think that your larger point here is that it's easy to cast the blame. There's blame enough to go around. The media is culpable. The politicians are culpable. Clinton was culpable. There was a failure of all kinds of delusions and entrancements, as we've described. But at the very end, the final culpability rests also with the people. They have a responsibility, if our system is to work, to be informed. And it's hard work. There's a lot of information. If you realize it, you can gather the information, you can pay attention, you can vote, you can make a difference. And I think that's what we can't afford to, again, to let us just slip through the ether of the time and float through history. That's a tragedy, and that we are paying for it now, and you're right. The information is there if you want it. Now, should it be better? Sure. Citizens can't complain about not being informed if they don't even try to be informed.
Our lines are all full, so let's go on and talk with some more callers. We'll go next to a listener in Savoy on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. I've enjoyed following Haynes Johnson quite a bit. I haven't read the current book. I'm looking forward to it. On that topic of Clinton's administration, I've recently read one by Peter Edelman, husband of Marion Edelman, and he had left the Clinton administration early when the poverty situation was being mishandled.
Yes.
I'm wondering how familiar you are with his ideas and whether you agree.
Well, Peter happens to be a personally good friend of mine. I've known him since he was a young man. He worked for Robert Kennedy.
I'll hang up.
I've known him. I know he and his wife very well, and I admire Peter. I think he's a very thoughtful and a man of great integrity, and so forth. So I am familiar with him. I see him, and when I'm in Washington, I'm now talking to you from Chicago, but I'm traveling the country. But he reflected a strong disagreement with Clinton over the policies that led to the treating the homeless and the welfare and so forth. And he had a very strong view he felt, if not betrayed, that Clinton had let him down. And I think that's a fair criticism.
Hope it gets to the caller's question. We'll go on and talk next with someone in Clifton on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning, Mr. Johnson.
Good morning.
And I'm glad you've written a commentary on the Clinton years, but I had no use for Bill Clinton, but I think there's enough blame to go around. The American one thing that I've noticed has been happening for years and years and years is the apathy and the permissiveness that's going on in America. The church is becoming so liberal now, and I'm just upset about a bunch of things, and I'm terribly, terribly upset that we got the wake-up call on September the 11th. I'd go back to Tom Brokaw and his what was it,
the Greatest Generation idea?
The Greatest Generation, yes. And I was a World War II veteran, and I don't want to put myself up on a pedestal, but it was a great generation because we did come together. The country came together with the people were doing with rationing and supporting the troops. And but the thing I want to go back to is our unpreparedness for World War II. We were not ready, and Roosevelt wanted us to get into it. I rated, until Clinton came along, I rated him worst president in my lifetime, until Bill Clinton came along. And the greatest president was Harry S. Truman. And the reason the Harry S. Truman, he said it the way it was, and he says, go ahead and drop the atomic bombs. Let's get the slaughter over. We were killing people at the rate of a million people a month. People need to realize this. We needed to get the war over. I know it was a terrible weapon, but we needed to win it. We need to get it done with. We were going to win it, but we already lost too many American lives, and too many people already been killed. But I just hope that this time, September the 11th, that we are awake and that we stay awake, we remain patriotic. I don't mean that we got to join together and all be as one. We can have a diversity of ideas. We can argue, debate things, and that's fine. But let's think about what is best for this country. Let's think about what is going to be best for my kids, what's going to be best for my grandkids, and what's going to be best for my great-grandkids. When I say mine, I mean all of the grandkids and all the great grandkids in this country. Let us be involved with other countries, but we don't need the United Nations.
Yeah. Well, thank you, sir. You really have said a lot there, and I think that your larger point about the need to be united, but also that doesn't mean we stop debating fiercely and over issues. We should, but we shouldn't destroy ourselves, and we shouldn't just point the finger, and we ought to have a little more respect for those who disagree with us, and that way you forge a united society, which you need, and you can't turn your back on the events in the country and abroad. That's what we did, and I really hope the lessons of this terrible situation we're in now come home to us.
I'm starting to hear signs of a new kind of debate about America's role in the world.
Yes.
Not just, you know, the fact that maybe we've neglected things and now we need, you know, international partners to deal with the war on terrorism, but our responsibility, not just as, you know, sort of the corporate sector reaching out and globalizing the economy, but morally around the world, that we have perhaps not engaged on a level of humanity with a lot of the countries that we've had relations with.
Well, part of the real hope for the future, this is sound like a truism, but I believe it could be true, is to educate ourselves so we understand other cultures, really understand them. We ought to teach languages in our schools, in our elementary schools, right down at the grade school level. So we ought to bring back history into the classroom, which is, sadly, I got to tell you, is not being taught. The idea of civics is an old-fashioned notion. This is a very complex society we have. Our governmental system was made to be difficult to work because we feared tyrants and kings and emperors. We've got to understand the process we have, and then to realize what it takes to have a society united. And if you educate people to understand, say, Islamic fundamentalism is of all shades. It's not just the Taliban. They are only one segment of it. There's a whole different range of attitudes and beliefs, and we ought to understand the disagreements with us and the reason America is so often hated. Envied, jealousy toward us, all that's probably natural, but the way you deal with that is to learn other cultures, and you begin to ameliorate the differences. That's what we've got to do. It's in our interest. It's not because it's the noble thing to do. It's in our self-interest to do so.
We have a couple callers waiting and just about 10 minutes left with Haynes Johnson, and we're talking about his book, The Best of Times, America in the Clinton Years, and a variety of other things. And we'll go next to a listener in Chicago on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi.
Yes.
I talked to you the last time you appeared on WILL, and I thought highly of you at that time. And I guess I still do, although I feel rather sad about the position that you've taken with respect to W. Sure, there's been an apparent revolution in his thought with regard to foreign policy, but it's bound to fail because his domestic policy is still the same as it was before, although it's covered up with lots of pretty words and gotta help the poor and all that sort of stuff, which is all garbage as far as he's concerned. Basically, his policy is the same. Corporatize this country's economy, and that which you can't corporatize here, you go abroad and deindustrialize this economy, so that we this country ends up as a banana republic. Basically, you're seeing the economy was slipping before 9/11, and that was all the product of what had been going on with industry leaving this country, and employment was going up very rapidly, and 9/11 only increased the trend.
I think your point's clear.
If all we do is learn the lessons of the threats we face abroad, that won't be enough. We've got to deal with the domestic concerns of the country, which are real and are divisive, and they need to be attended to. I don't know how Mr. Bush is going to handle that. I have not been a supporter of his domestic policies, and I still am not. I don't know whether he's going to go through a process of changing his policies toward domestic concerns, and we need to have an energy policy that's independent of the not just the drilling in the Arctic, which won't solve anything, but we really need to put our best minds. We need a Manhattan Project of our best scientists and technologists to devise make us independently secure of foreign oil sources, for instance. That should have been done 20 years ago. We need a lot of things to deal with the changing workforce and the displacement of workers in this country. There are all kinds of questions that arise out of this, so we'll see. But I think that there has been certainly a fundamental change in the way he and the administration have changed their views about America's role in the world, and we'll see about what happens to America's role at home. They go together. You can't separate them, and that's part of our challenge.
Real quickly, it seems to many people that Washington's response to the economic woes we're experiencing since the George W. Bush presidency has been tax cuts. And again, we're this economic stimulus package. The main thing that's being discussed, at least on the Republican side, is, again, more tax cuts.
Yeah, I think that's a debate we've got to have. It's starting now. And you can see echoes of it already out of the Congress. And it's critically important whether we mobilize the country and we take care of our need at home, whether we have a public works program, as we did in the Great Depression, or whether we have new jobs creation programs. We need something to put workers who are talented, who are thrown off not for any cause of their own, but they are out by the tens and tens of thousands now. And that's a permanent loss if we just let them slip through the cracks. We can't afford that. And so it has to. There's a fundamental difference operating here, and we should have a debate on that. I hope it's a debate that's civil. We don't destroy each other, don't call each other ignoble and unpatriotic Americans for disagreeing.
Very good. We have a couple callers left, and we'll try to get them both in the remaining time. Next is a listener in Urbana on line number 1. Good morning.
Hello. I'm very much enjoying your talk and look forward to reading your book.
Thank you, sir.
I would like to take issue with one thing that you said, and that is that we are engaged in a bat war with fundamentalist Islam, between the West and fundamentalist Islam. And I think that's a misunderstanding. I think the real contest is between progressive and secular Islam, or the Islamic peoples, and the fundamentalists.
Yes, but let me just say that I agree with you, and what I wrote in the book, it is exactly that point. I made the point that Islamic secular scholars and the majority of Islamic people did not agree with the Taliban. Say, for instance, when they destroyed those Bamiyan statues in the Bamiyan Valley, the Buddha statues, and they do not agree with the zealotry of sort of attacking the Western civilization. I'm talking about only a small part of the Islamic world, not the whole world.
Unfortunately, I think that part is growing, and that George Bush may win the battles he's fighting, but I think he has either already lost the war or may very well lose it very shortly.
Yeah,
the secularists and the progressives have lost their voice. They seem to be winning over the last few years. Even Iran seemed to be becoming more liberal.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's been reversed, and I think we may be in for a hellish time.
Well, I will see. I certainly share some of your apprehensions, but we'll just have to watch it and see.
We just have about 3 or 4 minutes left. We'll move quickly on to our next listener in Munster on line number 2. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm enjoying this conversation. I thought that after September 11th that the media would do a much better job in reporting things. And one of the things I was concerned about was I didn't hear much about Syria getting a seat on the Security Council. And I was wondering, what do you think, how do you think the media can do a better job? And also, do you ever think that the consortium that was looking over the votes from the Florida election, do you think they'll ever release the information? And my last thing is, how can I get a signed copy of your book?
Well, the last question, I'll be happy to autograph it. You sent it to me. You sent it to me at my home or my office in Washington. I'm in Washington in the telephone book. I'll be glad to send you an autograph copy. If you'll mail it to me, I'll mail it back to you and sign it to you.
Okay, thank you.
I'd be very, very delighted to do so.
Okay.
As far as your other questions about the media, I think it's been a much better overall coverage since September 11th. I mean, I think the reporting, for instance, I just cite the New York Times, which I just read this morning, my hotel room is superb every day. They have a whole section that is just cleared of advertising and a great loss of money, filled with all kinds of detailed and sophisticated reporting. Other papers are doing the same. Yes, I worry about the cable networks. They focus on the shallow and the sensational, the same kind of techniques they use in OJ and dramatic graphics and so forth. But I think the coverage is better, and we will have to watch it and see, and I hope that it continues to be, but I don't have any guarantees on that.
We have just about 2 minutes left, and there are many things, way many things, that we're not going to be able to get to that is covered in the book, and many of the things that we could branch off from that. But I wanted to ask you to talk about one of the points that you make, especially toward the end of the book. One of the lost opportunities during the Clinton age was reform of our political system.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering what you think, in this time of the new terrorism crisis, have we once again lost an opportunity to address political reform, or will this relate to that in some way to spur us?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because the previous caller's question about we haven't released the studies of the election that have been the consortium, the Florida debacle, and because we're afraid it might jeopardize the unity of the country. I think that's a mistake. I think we're big, we're power, we're mature people. We can take the truth always, and we can learn from it. And if we don't reform the system and get rid of the money and the politics and the corruption of money, it really is a corruption. John McCain and company are correct about that. We've got to have, at the very least, the lessons out of the last election. It's a scandal that the most technologically advanced society in history can't or is unwilling to provide machines that can accurately tabulate the votes completely and accurately. Just as an example, that's not a big deal. But we've got to do more than that. We've got to reform the way we vote. We've got to have get rid of the money in politics, and I think we ought to have a whole way of encouraging voting. I believe there ought to be a national holiday called an election day.
Mm-hmm.
Make a vote on Saturday and Sunday, and declare the winners on a Monday, and to call it Democracy Day. I mean, let's be proud of ourselves, and let's be true to what we are as a people.
Well, that's a great note to end it on, and we're here at the end of our time, so let me suggest for folks, if you'd like to read more, it's a really very well-written book, The Best of Times, America in the Clinton Years, recently published by Harcourt, and the author has been our guest, Haynes Johnson. To you, Mr. Johnson, thanks so much for spending the time with us.
Well, I've enjoyed it. I wish we had more time with your callers. They were great.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.